Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Australian Greens Senator Christine Milne. Christine was elected to represent Tasmania, which is a state of Australia, at the 2004 federal election and joined the Greens Senate team in July 2005. She was elected deputy leader of the Australian Greens in 2008. Senator Milne is a leader in the environment in Australia and overseas and has a long involvement in community activism and politics. She is also a United Nations Global 500 Laureate and was a Vice President of the IUCN, World Conservation Union, from 2005 to 2008. Senator Christine Milne, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you, Helen.
Now, the specific reason I wanted to interview you today, Christine, and I'll just say as introduction, I've known Christine for many years. She used to be a school teacher in Tasmania and was very, very concerned about the environment and got herself into politics. And now, as background, the Australian Greens are in fact a very powerful party in Parliament because they hold the balance of power in what's called a hung Parliament, where neither the Labor Party, which is like the Democrats, nor the Liberal Party, which is like the Conservatives, won a majority. So we've got a hung parliament and the Greens kind of get the say. So Christine, as a representative of the Australian Greens, went to Durban in South Africa where a major conference was just held, a United Nations conference on the future of global warming. So Christine, I know you're jet lagged. Would you like to give us a report, please, on what happened there?
Absolutely, Helen. And I just want to say that, Helen, you and I first spoke on the same platform back in 1987 in the campaign against a billion-dollar pulp mill, which was backed by a Canadian company, Naranda of Canada. So we've had quite a history together.
We have.
But, yes, Durban. I've been leading the push in Australia to get a carbon price, but also to bring on renewable energy, energy efficiency, and to have recognition for carbon in the landscape and trying to protect forests and wetlands and so on in that context. So having achieved the legislation in Australia, I wanted to go to Durban to lend my support to a higher level of ambition in reducing greenhouse gas emissions globally. So going into Durban, there were three main policy gaps that the world really need to look at. The first was the emissions gap. Now, what has been pledged by all countries around the world as their target, if you like, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which came out of Copenhagen and then was put into the UN FCCC system in Cancun, there's that level of emissions reduction. But the scientists, of course, have said if you want to constrain global warming to less than 2 degrees, you need to do much better than that. And so the gap there is between 6 and 11 gigatons of carbon dioxide that has to be reduced more than the pledges on the table. So that's the first gap.
What's a gigaton, Christine?
In terms of millions of tons.
Yeah.
It's 1,000 million tons.
So per year?
Yes, we've got a massive gap in reducing what is on the table and what needs to actually be achieved. And then in terms of the second gap is a financial gap. In which case the developing world was expecting the developed world to put billions of dollars on the table, $100 billion by 2020, to assist developing countries with adaptation to climate impacts. And so the upshot there is that somehow money had to be achieved to go into that fund. And then the third gap related to legal commitments, because the Kyoto Protocol first commitment period ends in 2012, and you had to replace that with some legally binding regime to get countries involved in reducing their emissions. So they were the three gaps: the legal gap, the financial gap, and the emissions gap. Well, what came out of Durban, which has been spun around the world as some great breakthrough, was actually only a political decision, because it didn't fill the gap on emissions, it didn't fill the gap on financing, and it hasn't filled the gap on a legally binding outcome. So I can just go through that quickly if you'd like.
Yes, please, we'd like that very much.
Okay, so let me go on, first of all, on the emissions reduction.
Right.
This is where the United States and Canada, supported by Australia and New Zealand, played an appalling role. You had the European Union had joined up with the Organisation of Small Island States, plus the least developed countries, plus Africa as negotiating blocks, and that's a lot of countries in those four blocks. They all joined up saying, we absolutely need to get a higher level of emissions reduction ambition to fill the gap, because we want to keep global warming to less than 2 degrees. In fact, those countries, actually the least developed and the small island states, want it down to less than 2 degrees. They want it to 1.5. Anyway, they had text on the table asking for a higher level of ambition, and the United States pushed very strongly to get rid of that text out of the agreement, and that was supported by Canada and by New Zealand and Australia. And I'm extremely ashamed of the behaviour of our governments in supporting dumping that from the text, and the result is that we still don't have a commitment to higher levels of ambition. That's something that will still be discussed into the future. But when you look at it in terms of the scientists have made it very clear, this is the critical decade, 2010 to 2020. If global emissions have to peak and start to come down in this decade, or we will not constrain global warming to less than 2 degrees. That's the fact. And so what we now have is a situation where we are on track for 3.5 or 4 degrees of warming, which effectively is runaway climate change. And so not addressing that reduction emissions gap is a serious failing. On the climate fund, the Green Climate Fund, the world was challenged with saying, OK, if you have to find $100 billion, it's a lot of money. Where is the world going to find it? We've got Europe in a financial crisis, the United States with financial problems and so on. And so there were two propositions put on the table. One was, well, we could tax bunker fuels for shipping. So have an international shipping tax that actually fed straight into that fund. Or we could also have a financial services tax, possibly like a Tobin tax, where every international transfer of funds had some small tax on it that was fed into a global climate fund. And I have to say here, once again, it was Australia who put up their hand opposing the shipping fund, and of course the United States joined in, and so you have a situation where once again developed countries frustrated that. So coming out of Durban, everybody is saying, oh, it's great, we got a green climate fund set up. Well, yes, they did in an administrative sense, that there is now a fund, but it's virtually an empty shell. The German government, the Danish government, put, you know, a few hundred million into that fund, but, you know, that's nowhere near $100 billion, and there's still no mechanism for pouring money into it. And this is at a time when developing countries need money for adaptation right now, because the impacts of climate change are actually right there in your face. Three Pacific Island nations have declared states of emergency in the last year.
Because they're drowning.
Yes, well, not drowning, actually drought, Helen.
Drought.
It hasn't rained in the Pacific for 7 months.
Really?
So Tuvalu, Tokelau and Kiribati have had to declare states of emergency because they've run out of water. Also, because of sea level rise, they get overwashed a lot more with the storm surges and high tide.
Mm.
And when that salt water goes across the land, they depend on the rainfall to, if you like, wash rinse off the salt off the surface, because with the temperatures you get high levels of evaporation, so you get a lot of salt left on the surface soil. And because it hasn't rained, and of course they've still had the overwash from high tides and storm surges, their ground is becoming impacted by salt. Plus, with the sea level rise, there's salt going into their fresh water lenses, salt water's getting in there. So the result is they can't grow their own food, they don't have fresh water to drink, and also the increased temperatures means that they're more vulnerable to coral bleaching. And what we're now finding, which I only realised from talking to them in Durban, is that with the coral bleaching, areas that have had severe environmental disturbance like that on the coral reef end up having a dinoflagellate grow on that area, so it's a kind of algae. The fish feed on that, and then they're toxic to humans because they get what's called ciguatera. So that's poisonous to humans if you eat the fish. So the people on these islands are losing their protein from fish, their ability to grow their breadfruit and taro and food, and no fresh water. So they're living in paradise, if you like, in terms of these beautiful islands in the Pacific. But the reality is they are in dire straits. And so they need money for particularly, they're having to establish small desalination plants. They're having to upgrade any capacity to capture water for when it rains. There's just so many things they need to do to be able to stay where they are. And plus, they're vulnerable to more cyclones and more intense cyclones as well. And so you can imagine how frustrating it is for those countries. And so, you know, the profound despair in their voices, because how many times do you have to tell the world you're living through this? And people just say, oh, thank you very much for that contribution. Now who's next, kind of thing. And their big question is, who will take my people? Because they recognise that this isn't sustainable, even if they can adapt in the short term. And so ultimately, we're going to have a treaty or under the Refugee Convention or some other convention to recognise that people are going to be displaced by climate change, and there is an obligation to take them. So that Green Climate Fund, the actions of developed countries in denying money to that fund because they don't want to tax shipping or financial services, it's not just wrong. It is morally completely unjustifiable in any which way you look at it. So on that gap, it's really bad what happened. In terms of the legally binding, that's the third issue. The Kyoto Protocol was legally binding. The first commitment period was 2008 to 2012.
And what did it say, actually, Christine?
The Kyoto Protocol basically was a protocol under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was agreed in 1997. And it was basically countries agreed to take a reduction in their greenhouse gas emissions that was legally binding. And if they failed to meet the targets that they had negotiated, then in the second Kyoto commitment period, they were expected to have a penalty applied of a 30% additional target in their next commitment, in the second commitment period. So Canada, for example, signed on to a reduction in its greenhouse gas emissions under the Kyoto Protocol, ratified the Kyoto Protocol actually at a meeting chaired by Canada in Montreal in 2005. But then, with a change of government in Canada, they completely ignored the target and are nowhere near it. They're miles over their target. And they have now said not only will they not honour their target, but Canada will not be part of a second Kyoto commitment period. So Canada is now, with the United States, one of the rogue nations when it comes to reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's, of course, because they're pushing for their tar sands exploitation. So with the Kyoto Protocol, what happened was the developing countries and Europe wanted a second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol to be negotiated and to be legally binding. But with pushback from the United States and from Canada and from countries like Australia, all saying, well, why should we have a second commitment period when China and India won't be bound by it because they're developing countries. There was a whole argument around that, and what was on the table essentially was, okay, we'll have a second Kyoto commitment period providing we get to a legally binding treaty where China, India and the United States would come in so that all the world's major polluters were covered by some legally binding framework, which is a sensible way of going. But what actually happened was all that has been agreed in terms of the legally binding framework with all the big emitters in is that in Durban it was agreed that there will be a negotiation which will lead to, hopefully, a treaty being finalised in 2015, which will come into effect post 2020, with no date as to post 2020 when, and the level of how much it will be legally binding is yet to be determined. All they've said is there'll be a legal outcome under the convention. Well, that can be anything. So essentially all they decided was that they'll agree this year, that they'll try to agree in 2015 to actually do something after 2020, and will decide at a later date whether that's legally binding. And on that basis, they then decided that, okay, we'll have a second Kyoto commitment period, but it won't be legally binding, it'll be voluntary. So where we've ended up is between 2012 and 2020, there will be nothing legally binding on any country in the world. And this is in the critical decade when global emissions have to peak and come down. And to make matters worse, and again, Australia played a very bad role here, supported by New Zealand and actually the European Union as well. And this was on the rules of the existing Kyoto Protocol, because they said, well, the rules that covered the legally binding first period need to just carry on until we get to something else that's legally binding. But they decided to change the rules that will apply into the future. And this is particularly important on forests. And what they did was create a massive rot. And this is because Europe wants to switch to a lot of biomass burning for energy, and they want to call it renewable energy. So they want to burn wood chips effectively as renewable energy, and they want to be able to use wood chips in the furnaces of steel mills, for example, to substitute coal. And the reason for wanting to use wood is because under the rules that they've all negotiated, you don't have to account for the emissions.
Why? Why not?
Well, this is I know it's completely outrageous. It is because if the wood comes from a developing country, they're not covered by the legally binding aspects of the Kyoto Protocol, so it comes in and the emissions aren't counted. And if it comes in from a developed country, like Australia or Canada, for example, it won't have to be counted, because this is where they created the loophole. They said that we don't want to take our emissions from logging on an evidence-based historical basis. So you'd have to say, this is what we logged last year or in the last 5 years, this is the evidence for us and this is our baseline. No, what they said was, we want to calculate the emissions that we would have produced if we had logged everything that was available to be logged in a certain year. So in the case of Australia, they said, look, let's look at what we could have logged in 2009 under the regional forest agreements in Australia. If we were to max that out into the future, if we cut down every stick, what would be the maximum? And so they said that'll be our baseline. So that means,
good God,
that if you log less than that projected baseline, then you get a credit for it.
Really?
Yes. And if
who
you
are the idiots that did this, Christine?
Well, and if you log more than that, you get punished. But because you've maxed out the baseline, you're never going to log more than it, because you've already included in everything you could have logged. But the reality is that Australia can actually lift its level of native forest logging, come in under its projected baseline, and get credit for it under the new rule. So this is what is really worrying here. Is this is going to create a huge push for logging of native forests around the world, because we've already seen that with the European 10% directive that they currently have on biofuels has already led to massive transformation on conversion of native forests in Indonesia, Malaysia, throughout the tropical forests, conversion of tropical forests to palm oil, both for the Chinese domestic market in terms of cooking oils, but also to go into Europe for biofuels. Now, by creating this loophole for biomass so that they don't have to count the emissions, so Europe can say, look, we reduced our emissions, but it's actually accounting. It's not actually in terms of what the atmosphere is seeing. What we're now going to see is a massive driver to log Africa's forests to ship to Europe for biomass burning. And, of course, having now lost the wood chip market from Australia as a result of Japan not wanting native forest wood chips because they've accepted the argument they ought not to come from native forests. Now, of course, Japan will be trying to import wood for biomass burning. And so suddenly the native forest loggers around the world have got two choices. They can either log for biomass or they can protect these forests and put them into and claim the carbon credits on them. And it will depend which is the higher price as to what happens to our forests. So I'm pretty devastated about the role that Australia has played, along with Canada, the US and Europe, in effectively rorting the rules under the voluntary Kyoto Protocol that is being taken forward. So I think you can see, Helen, that the three gaps, as I said before, one was how to reduce the emissions gap, one was how to reduce the finance gap for adaptation for developing countries, and how to reduce the legal uncertainty gap. What we've come out of Durban with is actually more gaping holes and bigger gaps than we went into it with, but we have a political declaration that everyone says, oh, marvellous, marvellous, we made progress. Well, in terms of the climate, we haven't made progress, and in terms of biodiversity, not only its climate impact, but loss of habitat because of native forest conversion is going to be, you know, yet again another major focus for environment groups and the rest of us who care around the world.
I'm interviewing Senator Christine Milne, who's an Australian Greens senator from the Australian Parliament, who's just been in Durban. Christine, I'm absolutely flabbergasted and speechless about what has just happened about the Native Forest Agreement and what can happen. Who led the charge for this preposterous proposal that was adopted?
Well, it was led by the European Union, by the Scandinavian countries. So
why? Finland, why? What have they got to gain by destroying the world's forests and burning them to make electricity and produce more CO2? What have they got to gain? I would have thought the Scandinavian countries would be more intelligent.
Well, Finland and Sweden led the charge to get the policy position adopted in the European Union so that then the European Union took it forward. And that's because, as you would be aware, Finland and Sweden are substantial wood-producing countries. And now that they want to go massively to increased biomass to get out of burning coal so that they can meet their emissions reduction target.
And they don't have to measure the CO2 being produced from burning wood.
Exactly, because it's classified, biomass is classified as renewable energy.
Why is it classified as renewable energy, burning wood?
Well, that's the point. It should not be classified as renewable energy. Especially if it's coming from primary native forests around the world.
But how can they classify that as renewable energy, Christine?
Well, Helen, if I had been at the negotiating table, I can tell you, I went to every one of these delegations,
yeah,
and I explained to them what is going on, that already the European Union is leading to massive forest destruction because of its 10% biofuel declaration.
Yeah.
And I said, you're about to do exactly the same again to the forests of the Congo, to the forests of Indonesia, PNG. And, of course, they don't care because Europe wants to actually have its... It wants to be able to say, look how we reduced our emissions. Germany also, quite rightly, wants to shut down its nuclear reactors. Now, it's got... It's shut down 9 nuclear reactors and I think it's got another 8 or 9 to go by the early 2020s.
Mm.
And it has to replace that energy somehow. And so it sees biomass together with a massive investment in wind and solar as being the way to achieve that. And already quite a number of Germany's steel mills have reduce the amount of coal they're using in their furnaces and up the amount of wood. And so it's estimated that Britain will import 12 times as much wood as it currently does.
Oh, my God.
And that Europe will import 4 times as much wood as it currently does under these new rules. So you, as you can see, essentially the logging industry around the world got a leg up from the European Union, supported and backed by the usual suspects, Australia, New Zealand and the US and Canada, to rot the rules. And this is why I say that a lot of the emissions reductions are going to be effectively creating a creative accounting. They will appear on paper as significant reductions in emissions because of the reduction in coal and because biomass from burning energy is therefore renewable, therefore no emissions, because you're not counting the emissions at source. And what the NGOs, of course, were arguing, as I was arguing too, that you have to count the emissions from logging at the source, regardless of whether they're coming from a developed or a developing country.
What do you mean at the source? What
as in where
mean?
They're logged. As in where
they're logged. Well, why don't you count the CO2 that's coming out of the chimneys in Europe from the wood that's imported from the Congo? I don't understand.
Well, either way, you at the moment, for example, when you... You can't have double counting, so you either count the emissions at the place in which the primary source, so where you log the forest or where you dig up the coal.
Well, how do you work out how much CO2 a forest that is being logged will produce at the source? How do you work that out?
Well, essentially, there's a methodology for determining how much carbon how much carbon intensity in hectareages, etc. But either way, I don't. Essentially, whether they count the emissions from burning coal or burning wood or burning oil where it is burned or where it is extracted is a moot point. But the thing is, it has to be counted. It can't not be counted. And the problem we've got at the moment is that with wood, it is not counted either where it is logged or where it is burnt.
And I still can't understand why. I still can't understand how they can say that it's renewable energy. I don't... Where does that logic or philosophy come from, Christine?
Well, I don't know, Helen. All I know is that in rational terms and in climate terms, it is completely unjustifiable.
Yeah.
As you are saying, it is completely wrong, which is why... in the negotiations of the carbon package in Australia, the Greens insisted that native forests be not allowed as to achieve credits as renewable energy under the Australian Renewable Energy Target Scheme, because we absolutely agree. This is ridiculous. We do not want to burn fantastic biodiverse primary forests just to put them in furnaces. You know, this is ridiculous, and we mustn't be doing it. They're magnificent carbon stores, and they should stay where they are. But the problem is, you've got countries around the table who are making all the right speeches about worrying about global warming, but when it comes down to it, they all take their own national sovereign interests and put those ahead of the planet. And unfortunately, for a lot of developing countries, they are caught in between. In some cases, you've got corruption, a lot of illegal logging going on. You've got a lot of deals with some of the big logging companies throughout Asia, getting into PNG's forests, Indonesia's forests, and in Africa, of course, the Congolese forests. So we've got, you know, all the problems that you can imagine. But the other problem with the negotiations is because most of these countries, still blessed with fantastic forests, are also recipients of overseas aid financing. And so when people try to take a stand for the forests, countries are often bullied by the aid donors into backing off, because otherwise they'll lose their aid funding.
Oh.
That's the way that these negotiations work. And I can tell you, I don't know the extent to which it happened in Durban, because you usually only find out after the event.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, at previous COPs, the Australian government has tried to bully Pacific Island countries in saying, now listen to me, you get plenty of money from us, you better vote the right way.
And Does this mean now with this new change in the law about renewable energy, meaning you can burn wood and you don't count the CO2, will that impact upon the stand that the Greens have taken in the Australian Parliament to not call burning forests renewable energy? Will that impact here or not?
Well, it
will
won't,
it override?
It won't, no, it won't override. It won't change the domestic legislation, and we will absolutely insist that there will be no biomass burning in Australia. The problem is that it doesn't stop the logging industry exporting wood chips. To be burnt. And in fact, when I talked with some of the Scandinavian pulp and paper companies, they have said that they think that probably Tasmanian wood chips have been used in furnaces in Japan and not gone into the pulp and paper process for quite some years.
Oh,
and if you
God.
Actually went and found out, you'd find that they're using much higher even quality wood chips from plantations in the pulp and paper process, and that they've been using the very cheap native forest wood chips from Tasmania in their furnaces. So the problem for us, Helen, is we can stop biomass burning from native forests in Australia, but if there is now going to be a global market for biomass, then it doesn't stop the export of wood chips overseas, and so the campaign for the forest becomes much harder.
Why can't, Christine Milne, why can't we stop the export of wood chips from Australian native forests overseas? Why can't we do that by law?
Well, you can't intervene and say that you can't export a certain commodity. What we can do is say you can't log native forests. I mean, that is what it comes down to. So the way of dealing with this in Australia is to do what we have been trying to do for some time, that is end the logging of native forests in Australia, recognising that we need them for their carbon stores, we need them because they're fantastically biodiverse, we need them for their water values, all of the connectivity in the landscape for species, all of those things. We need to end native forest logging, and our campaigning has to be lifted in the next 12 months.
Yes.
As you know, we have an agreement between the Prime Minister and the Premier of Tasmania, the intergovernmental agreement to end logging in a large part of Tasmania's high conservation value forests, but tragically, the logging goes on every day in defiance of that signed agreement.
Why?
Because the Prime Minister will not step in, and she will not insist that Forestry Tasmania stop it, to make an end to it. And it is really, as Bob Brown has said, the leader of the Greens here in Australia, the Prime Minister's word is being clear-felled every day as new coupes are being logged in those high conservation value areas. And as we speak, some of the conservation groups are setting up a tree sit in some of these high conservation value forests because they're going to come under intensive activity from the loggers over the summer. So again, Prime Minister Gillard has got a lot to answer for here. She's already poured a lot of money into the Tasmanian logging industry, which was meant to be for transition out of native forest logging. Mm. And instead of that, it's effectively been a rescue package for the loggers to tide them over until they get new markets. And unfortunately, in this global context, the loophole that Australia has secured in the land use change and forestry rules under the Kyoto Protocol, together with Europe, Canada and the US, has meant that our job has now become harder.
I'll help you, Christine. So now, okay, let's go to the global scene again, Senator Milne. I'm interviewing Senator Christine Milne, who is a Green senator from the Australian Parliament, and the Green Party holds the balance of power in the Australian Parliament. So you obviously are pretty devastated by what's happening in Durban. You're one of the few people really speaking the truth about what it means, whereas the press is sort of sycophantal to the powers that be to say, look, it's a wonderful agreement. So let's talk about the dynamics behind all of this non-agreement and putting off any decent agreement about global warming until after 2020, when it's going to be too late. Who are the drivers behind these decisions, would you say, Christine Milne?
Well, you know, when it comes down to it, it is the impact of multinational corporations backing the old economy and the old fossil fuel world. So essentially you've got big oil, big coal, big minerals, big forests, etc., who are pushing these outcomes through their governments. And the real problem here is the United States. You know, there is no way getting away from it. And, of course, Canada is behaving extremely badly at the moment too. But the real problem is the United States, because if you go back to it, the whole agreement originally back in the 90s, the Kyoto Protocol, was signed on the basis that the developed world had to take responsibility for the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that the developed world had put there and created the problem. And therefore, they had to take emissions reductions so that developing countries like China, like India, like Brazil, like South Africa could all get their people out of poverty and continue to grow economically, recognizing that would be an increase in greenhouse gases from them. So the developed world had to reduce theirs so that the developing world could increase theirs, but the whole lot could stay within a carbon budget that would constrain global warming to less than 2 degrees and therefore give us a 50% chance of a safe climate. That was essentially the parameters of the deal.
Right.
Now, of course, what then happened was the developed countries reneged. The United States never ratified the convention. Canada has ignored its targets and says it won't bother anymore. It's not going to do anything. You've got Australia saying, well, we're not going to sign up to anything unless India and China do. So you can see from the point of view of the larger developing countries that what they're seeing is a complete betrayal of the principle underpinning the agreement they went into in the first place. And this is where the United States comes in so badly. We now have a standoff globally, if you like, between the two superpowers. You've got the United States and China vying for which is going to be the superpower of this century. And you have Europe now recognising its slipping backwards in terms of global authority, but is now forming power blocks with the developing world in trying to address climate change and advance its own economy, if you like, through trying to get competitive advantage in low-carbon economy technologies, and Germany, of course, leads the way in that. So Obama, when President Obama was elected, he made a lot of speeches in that campaign on climate change. He took a very strong view. And so people thought at last, if the Democrats are elected in the United States, if President Obama comes to power, then he will act on climate change. He will come into the talks as a positive force and everything will get on track for serious climate action. Unfortunately, President Obama invested his political capital in only in the health reforms. Not that that's a bad thing. That was obviously a good thing to do, but that was it. He then abandoned climate change. And in fact, the position played by the delegation, the role played by the delegation from the US in Durban is no different from the role it played under George Bush, just as obstructive, recalcitrant, very small negotiating mandate. And it's very clear that Obama did not want anything to come out of Durban that would give the Republicans and the Tea Party in the US...
Oh, it's politics.
Yes, it's totally politics that would give the Republicans in the US any kind of leg up in the argument leading into next year's presidential election in the US. So the US came to Durban to make sure that the smallest possible outcome occurred so that Obama would not be disadvantaged in the presidential election. And, of course, that was backed by other countries for their own political reasons. Of course, Prime Minister Harper in
Canada,
exactly the same backwardness, because he's being pushed by the big resource-based companies pushing on the coal sands. Tar sands. And, of course, in Australia, you've got the coal industry playing such a massive role. And New Zealand has moved massively to the right as well. So you know, it's really pretty sad. And in terms of the global politics, in my view, the biggest hope is China. China's got an appalling human rights record, and it's difficult to see any progress on that in the short term. But China has, if the regime in China is to survive, it has to acknowledge that there is now a massive increasing gap between the rich in cities in China and the poor in rural areas. Plus, there's massive pollution that is making people sick from all this industrial development. Also, huge environmental degradation and dropping of the water table. And so China is already experiencing quite a lot of labour strikes. And, you know, you don't read it in the Australian press, but you, if you look far enough, you find that, you know, 1,000 people are rioting here and there on wages and working conditions at various times. So China has now got a massive political imperative to contain social unrest and disorder by improving environmental outcomes and improving the opportunities for education and better jobs in rural China. So they are now moving very fast to gain competitive advantage globally in the low economy, low carbon economy technologies. China wants to up its world market share of electric vehicles, for example. It has invested hugely in very fast trains. Because of the massive output of solar panels, the critical mass of panels, China has driven the drop in price of solar panels, which have gone down about 50% over the last 2 years, and that and globally, and that's because of the number that are coming out of China. China has also said, right, it's included a big cut in carbon intensity for its economy in its five-year plan, but it's also got seven provinces in China moving to pilot emissions trading schemes with a view to going to a national scheme by 2015. Now, in my view, that is the game changer. If China moves to national emissions trading in 2015, Australia's moving to global flexible pricing in 2015, New Zealand's got emissions trading, the European Union's got emissions trading, South Korea's moving to it, and California's starting on the 1st of January next year, then there will be a real isolating effect on the United States, and China, I think, is going to move closer to the position of the rest of the world to on climate change, because in part it has to domestically, and because it will be seen to be on the right side of history compared with the United States on climate change, and that will lead to greater political isolation of the United States. So there's a big picture game being played here, and it was also played out in the Australian Parliament when President Obama came and made his speech saying that while America had been in Afghanistan and Iraq, clearly they'd taken their eyes off the Pacific. I'm just paraphrasing. I mean, he didn't actually say those words.
Mm.
So now China had moved in massively into the Pacific and into Africa by investing huge amounts of money in aid programs in many of those countries. And so the United States has now said we need to move back into the Pacific, and that's why they want a base in Darwin. And that's why they want to have their the US Navy operating in the Indian Ocean out of Perth. And it's why the United States and Australia were collaborating not only on the US selling nuclear technology to India, which they did a couple of years ago, but for Australia to sell uranium to India. And it's obvious that it's a containment strategy for China. So as you can see, the climate talks are just a subset of the global repositioning of geopolitics, and China has, I think, made a decision that going with climate action is a better political option for it in this century in that geopolitical fight. And I think if the United States keeps up the way it's going, it will lead to increasing isolation for the US and Canada with it in the coming decade.
What a fascinating summary, Christine. I'm interviewing Senator Christine Milne from the Australian Parliament, who's the Deputy Leader of the Australian Greens in the Parliament, who hold the balance of power. Now, Christine, I want you to describe to the audience what carbon trading means, because I really don't understand it myself. And you describe all the countries that are going to move into carbon trading, including our own in Australia. But what actually does it mean? Because to me, what I've read is it hasn't worked in Europe because the sort of the mafia get into it and they can distort it and make money and the like. Why don't we just put a flat tax on carbon, like $40 per ton, and tax the people producing the carbon rather than buying and selling carbon credits? I don't get it.
Okay, well, there are two ways of going. If you want to, I'll explain it this way. Up until now, traditional politics, both Democrat and Republican in the US, Liberal and Labor in Australia, and the same in Canada, have treated the earth as a free commodity. So you can dump as much waste into the atmosphere or the oceans as you like for free. And you assume that there's an infinite amount of natural resources to be dug up and
chopped down
and shipped away. So essentially the earth is free. You can dig it up, cut it down, and that'll just keep giving forever. And you can dump all the consequent waste of the transformation of those products into then atmosphere or ocean, and that's free. Over the last couple of decades, 3 or 4 decades, people have said, well, you actually need to put a price on what you're digging up out of the earth in terms of royalties that you pay when you cut down a forest or dig up a coal mine. But you're still allowed to dump all of the waste that comes from those processes into ocean and atmosphere for free, and hence the polluter pays principle came up and so was developed, saying, hey, there is a limited capacity for the atmosphere and oceans to absorb waste, and therefore we have to reduce the amount of waste going into them, and we have to reduce the amount we're digging up and cutting down, and so we need to put a price on it so that it's not quite so easy to do. And you can do that, as you've just said, by just saying we'll put a tax on it. The problem with a tax on it is, yes, they will pay, but it doesn't necessarily mean they will stop putting out as much waste or digging out as much stuff, depending on how profitable it is and how high the tax is, so how level of disincentive. So you get a financial outcome, you get money coming into the coffers, but you don't have a guaranteed environmental outcome of saying there is a limit to that. Once you reach that limit, you can't dig up any more or dump any more into atmosphere. So that's where the idea of emissions trading comes from, as being a better environmental outcome than a tax, because essentially it says that we are going to put a cap. That's why it's called a cap and trade system. We're going to put a cap on the amount you can put into the atmosphere. And you create the number of permits that come up to that cap. So the number of tons of carbon dioxide up to that cap creates one permit equals one ton. And for polluters, they have to buy as many permits as they need to be able to pollute.
Continue to pollute.
Yes, but they continue to pollute. But, of course, there is a restricted supply of those permits, because there's only the same number of permits as come up to that total limit, and therefore they have to have an ability to bring their costs down over time, and they do that by reducing the amount they pollute. Therefore they don't have to buy as many permits, and they can sell any excess ones they've got to people who need to buy them. So there is a driver in the system to keep reducing the amount of carbon dioxide, providing that the cap continues to be tightened, if you like. And that's why I keep saying we need to increase the level of ambition or the level of targets, which is essentially means you're continuing to turn the screws so that the cap comes further
reduce the cap. Once the cap is at a certain level, nobody is allowed to go beyond it because they can't buy the permits to do it.
That's right. And then if you keep strengthening the cap by reducing it all the time.
Yeah.
Less and less permits are available. Therefore, industries have to become more and more efficient or change to renewables or whatever. And that's why the generosity of the target is such a contentious view. And that's why the Greens have argued we need to have a stringent target. We need to really put the screws on this and bring it down as quickly as possible. And that's why we've always argued with the government, who want a really slack target, which would enable industries to keep doing what they want to do. And that's why there's such a worry about this loophole in the forest, because if you create all these fake permits, if you like, or fake carbon credits that haven't really been earned because you just did it with creative accounting, then you destroy the integrity of the system. And that's what you were referring to in Europe, where they made the mistake of having a way too weak regime to start with and too many free permits. And Russia got all this so-called, that's what the term hot air is, credits that weren't really earned, that were just creative accounting. And so one of the other things that happened in Durban was people recognised that we needed to get all these fake permits, if you like, out of the system, or unearned permits. And that the push was on to take them out of the system for the second Kyoto commitment period. But once again, Australia argued against this and wanted them rolled over into the second period. So any you hadn't used up, you could roll over and keep for the second period, which defeats the idea of screwing, you know, continually screwing down the cap.
Where are the heads, the brains, the minds of these Australian politicians who would understand innately that carbon is the most concentrated source of carbon dioxide, that they were the biggest supplier of coal to China? Where the hell are their heads, Christine Milne? I don't get it. Well, they're destroying the planet. They're destroying the planet.
Well, their heads are in, that's why you asked me before about the internal dynamics, and I said it's being driven by the large corporates, the old fossil fuel sector, big coal, big oil. And that's exactly what's happening in Australia, and big gas, as it turns out, in this case as well. What you've got is a party that went into the election saying they would not introduce carbon pricing, they weren't going to do anything. They agreed to do so because the Greens signed the agreement to give them government to do so. So on the one hand, they've moved on a range of carbon policies. But on the other hand, their whole focus on keeping the economy dependent on fossil fuels, more than 50% of Australia's exports are in minerals. 50%, more than 50% of our exports. And so the government is looking to say, well, our export income from coal and gas and iron ore are such that we are going to continue to back and subsidise those industries. So we've, on the one hand, said we want to act on climate change. On the other, we are exporting vast amounts of emissions into the atmosphere via other countries. So it's a tragedy. It's no different from what the United States, Canada are doing. And it's difficult to see, sitting here in 2011, that we can possibly constrain global warming to less than 2 degrees. As I said, we're on track for 3.5. And unless there is some dramatic shift in people saying, right, that's it, we are moving to renewables, and the Greens are saying, absolutely, we need to get to 100% renewables as quickly as possible. If we don't, then we're going to have planetary, we already have a planetary crisis with global warming and loss of biodiversity. But the question is it too late to stop this dynamic? And that's the question that needed to be addressed in Durban, and it wasn't. And frankly, I think it's getting to the point, the scientists have said, if the emissions don't peak and come down this decade, we can't constrain global warming to less than 2 degrees, we can't stop runaway climate change, and that's what we're facing.
Well, I heard the president of the International Energy Agency speak in Turkey, where we were addressing the Turkish Engineers Association, and he said if things continue as they are, that by the end of the century, we'll see a 6 degree centigrade rise in temperature.
Yes, absolutely. And it's entirely possible that that could be the case. And
which is antithetical to life.
Yeah, that's right.
We won't survive that.
We are facing a It's a planetary crisis that I don't think people have really internalised yet. But we're going to see massive species extinction. We're going to see, as I said before, with Pacific Island nations, we're seeing it already in Africa. We're going to see a food security crisis globally as we lose, as we did with the Russian grain crop, was lost because of the drought and the fires in Russia. The crops were lost around the rest of the world, including in Australia, because of extreme weather events. And the result was massive food inflation in the Middle East, and where they import most of their grain and their diet is bread-based. And the result was the riots in Tunisia that began the Arab Spring.
The Arab Spring,
that
yes.
That is a global warming consequence. Yeah. And we're going to see more of this. Bangladesh, you've got people being their whole lives jeopardised every day as the tides come in, as people live on those levees. We're going to see massive dislocation of people.
Millions of ecological refugees.
Exactly. And I just think Connie Hedegaard, who was the chair of the climate talks in Copenhagen, spoke in Durban this week, and she just said, those countries that are blocking action have to accept that they are taking on an unbearable responsibility. And I just sat there and I just thought, it is totally unbearable. It is so unprecedented that there is one generation that can impact what life will be like for every generation that comes after them, and that is the people who are making decisions right now in this decade are the ones who bear the responsibility, because if it's allowed to go beyond the tipping points, there is no going back, and it's a very uncertain future. So that's why, you know, you can either despair and give up,
or
you can say, we will fight. And I take the view that we will fight, because you just, in my whole experience of campaigning, which I've been doing now for a very long time, is that you just keep on prosecuting the argument, and something will happen that you couldn't have anticipated that will come out of left field. It may be an appalling thing, like Fukushima. It may be some political change you just can't anticipate. But if you have kept campaigning, ultimately there will be a breakthrough. And that's what led to the carbon pricing in Australia, with the Greens getting balance of power in both houses, which no one expected to occur. That's how that came about. And, you know, I think we just carry on, because I just can't believe that at some point humanity won't wake up to itself.
Yes, really, it's a practice of global preventive medicine. Christine, we've run out of time. Look, it's been a very erudite, fascinating, depressing, but also somewhat exciting discussion. I thank you so much for coming on when you're jet-lagged. You've just got back from Durban. And we really appreciate it.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you, Christine. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was the Australian Green Senator, Christine Milne. What a fascinating, depressing, and I suppose in the end optimistic discussion. It's up to all of us, or we're doomed. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back with another fascinating program next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.